gives you the ability when you're setting policy to hopefully be looking out the front windshield instead of the back windshield window.
Alaska lawmakers attend the National Energy Council meeting in Wyoming. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a look at how moths are responding to climate change in Alaska.
There are lots of them. They exceed in biomass, the moose and other plant-eating animals.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Every March, the Alaska legislature shuts down so lawmakers can travel to Washington, D.C. to participate in the Energy Council. The council is a nonprofit whose stated mission is to facilitate discussion about energy and environmental issues. But the trips have frequently been criticized as taxpayer-funded junkets. The Washington meeting is just one of four the group holds every year. The latest was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, over the weekend. Stephanie Joyce was there, and as she reports, so were some Alaskan legislators and Alaskan lobbyists.
Sitting down to a breakfast with multiple fork options in the well-appointed Jackson Lake Lodge, it's not hard to see why Energy Council meetings have drawn criticism in the past. But Sitka Senator Bert Stedman says those who find fault with the organization he's chaired for the last year simply don't understand its importance.
For instance, in Alaska, we have an industry that generates $20 billion in revenue a year. It's the oil industry. It's huge. And we have to set tax policy. You can't do that in a vacuum. You have to understand how the industry operates and how the structure internationally is put together, and it's all different around the world.
The Energy Council is made up of 12 states, 3 provinces, and Venezuela. Companies like ConocoPhillips, BP, and Exxon underwrite portions of the event. But member states also pay about $40,000 a year in dues, and many, including Alaska, cover the cost of legislators' travel expenses. Stedman says not only is that worth it, it's a steal.
It gives you the ability when you're setting policy to hopefully be looking out the front windshield instead of the back windshield window.
There were a lot of issues on the agenda at the meeting, from fracking to regulatory battles over coal. But Stedman says the most important for Alaska was the discussion surrounding natural gas exports. Many Alaskan legislators want to build a pipeline that could bring natural gas from the North Slope to South Central, and then from there on to Asia, where prices and demand are higher. But Wyoming, Canada, and Australia all want to do the same thing. And in the latter cases, they're much further along in the process. Fairbanks Senator Kathy Giesel says that means Alaska is going to need to push harder to get the project going.
We need to get our act together. The other thing that we'll have to be addressing is our fiscal regime. We can't tax gas excessively, or we will not have a marketable product. It will be too expensive.
Of course, that's been the party line forever. But Giesel says it isn't a waste of time and money to repeat the conversation about it.
The value of that is the relationships that I have formed here. I've gotten to know many Wyoming legislators and Idaho legislators, Colorado. And after these meetings are over, we've collaborated together.
Kara Moriarty, the executive director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, agrees with Giesel that relationships are the most valuable takeaway from Energy Council events. Relationships with her counterparts in other states and with legislators. She says having the opportunity to chat with them when they're not on the clock is extremely valuable.
The demands on their time are just so much more during session than it might be at a conference like this. So, you know, we'll go on a hike or, you know, do some of those things in between the sessions. So especially in an environment like the Grand Tetons, this is a pretty spectacular.
But Senator Stedman says conversations with Alaskan industry representatives aren't the most valuable ones.
The BP and Conoco guys were here. I had dinner with them last night. I meet with them every year several times for the last 11 years. I mean, I meet with them all the time in Juneau. What it gives me, though, is an avenue here to speak with some of the people that are involved in the coal industry, the electrical grid, things like that that we wouldn't normally get exposed to.
Stedman and Giesel were among just a handful of Alaskan lawmakers who got that exposure at this meeting. But come March, you can be sure that much of the legislature will head to Washington, D.C. for their own taste of what the Energy Council has to offer. In Jackson Hole, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Interior Department's top offshore oil official says he welcomes a detailed set of recommendations from the Pew Trust on what standards should be required for Arctic drilling. Pew wants a fleet of ice-capable vessels, Arctic-hardened pipelines and tanks, and solid consultation with local people. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Director Tommy Boudreau calls the report thoughtful. Many environmental groups flat out oppose offshore Arctic drilling, but Pew's Marilyn Hyman says they do not go that far.
Pew does not have a position that we oppose all offshore drilling, but we do believe there are ways that this can be done right.
Lois Epstein of the Wilderness Society says before her organization would drop its opposition to Arctic drilling, the environment needs to be understood better, protected areas set aside, and regulatory oversight needs to be adequate. She says Pew's recommendations involve that third point of regulatory oversight. The industry generally agrees there needs to be standards, but wants flexibility in how it meets them. Pew wants things spelled out. Pew includes a lot of technical details in its recommendations, like active loggers that can sense how solid cementing is in well casings and remote control capabilities. It also wants some major equipment permanently kept in Alaska waters so it's readily available.
One of our major recommendations is there needs to be a containment system that can stop the spill and a relief rig that can also stop the spill in case the containment system doesn't work in the region, up in the Arctic.
Interior is due to release its Arctic standards around the end of the year. The Bureau of Land Management says its strategy for cleaning up old oil wells in the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska will focus initially on 16 high-priority sites. Alaska BLM Director Bud Cribley says the 16 pose high risk to the surface. The federal government from the 1940s to the 1980s directed that 136 exploratory wells be drilled in the more than 35,000 square mile reserve. The BLM plan includes an assessment of the surface and subsurface conditions of each well. The agency says more than half of the wells require no additional action because they have been remediated or they pose no threat. Another 50 are in various stages of cleanup. The BLM says surface cleanup at three sites on the Simpson Peninsula could begin next year. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a surprise visitor at a downtown Juneau bar.
And as soon as I got to the bar door, made a left and walked in like he wanted to have a beer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The world's northernmost moths may be dealing with a changing climate more effectively than some scientists expected. In fact, they may be surviving rising temperatures better than their southern counterparts. That's according to a study out today in the journal Global Change Biology. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
There are lots of moths in the forests of the far north.
You have to look a little close and care a little bit to notice.
Matt Ayers is a biology professor at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. He admits moths, or Lepidoptera, as they're known generally in Latin, are pretty nondescript.
Most of them are brown or gray moths as adults, but there are lots of them. They exceed in biomass the moose and other things that you may be familiar with in plant-eating animals.
As caterpillars, Lepidoptera are voracious plant eaters. They're also a main source of food for birds. As moths, they're nocturnal, so bats like to eat them too. Because of their abundance and diversity, Ayers says they're prime candidates for climate change research. He and colleagues looked at long-term data for more than 300 species of moths in Finland. They found widespread response to rising temperatures.
We also found that they didn't all respond uniformly. So some of the species fly at about the same time, same calendar day each year, regardless of the temperature, probably because they're controlled by how long the days are, the photo period. And some have a mix of those two control systems, and some species seem to have other control systems that we don't know what they are yet.
Ayer says the most surprising results involved the farthest north moth populations.
We found that the northern species were actually somewhat less sensitive to the temperatures than the southern species. So although the timing of their biology also changes a lot from warm years to cold years, not by as much as if they were the same as the southern populations.
Essentially, the northernmost moths are buffered from the effects of rapid climate warming. Initially, Ayer says the research team expected the opposite response, but he's since given the results some thought.
It makes sense to us now, even if we were surprised initially. At high latitudes where temperatures are frequently cool, there's strong selection for organisms like caterpillars and moths and plants to be able to accomplish more metabolism, more biological activity at relatively low temperatures.
The team used information from a unique monitoring database run by the Finnish Environmental Institute.
It's called Nocturna, which is now a 20-year program. It's a moth monitoring scheme. Which has a network of almost 100 forest sites distributed over the full length and breadth of Finland, which extends from about the latitude of Anchorage to about Barrow. So it's a good match with Alaska.
Nocturna involves a large network of volunteers who use black lights and stale beer to trap, identify, and count Lepidoptera. Ayer says the next step is to find out how other organisms might respond to climate change.
Now we want to know even more than before. We don't know of comparable insect data that could be brought to bear on this yet.
He's not sure if studies already exist that compare temperature sensitivities among plants in the north. Ayer says he'd be interested to compare patterns among Lepidoptera species and the plants they feed on to find out how climate change might affect those relationships. The research done by Ayers and colleagues appears in the latest issue of Global Change Biology. It was funded by Finland's Joensuu University Foundation. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
There's new hope that a derelict downtown Fairbanks landmark can be spared the wrecking ball. The Polaris building could be torn down, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, its Anchorage-based owner isn't giving up.
It took Mark Marlowe a decade to realize renovation of the McKinley building in Anchorage into a viable apartment complex, and he seems to be working a similar time frame in Fairbanks. The owner of the Polaris building says reports due out in coming weeks will determine the viability of renovating the long-vacant Fairbanks Hotel. Up against a September 30th action deadline, Marlowe told the city council an engineering analysis of the 11-story building is nearing completion.
They've been pulling concrete off of walls and exposing rebar joints and connections. They've excavated some of the floor in the basement and taken several core samples throughout the building in various places to test the strength of the concrete. And they'll take all that data and put it into their model and have a report for us to look at here later in the month of October.
Marlowe, who's working with an unnamed investor, anticipates having an updated building appraisal and rental market study done sometime next month as well. Marlowe has been pursuing a plan to renovate the Polaris into retail space and apartments for 7 years and came close to putting a financing package together in 2009 when the recession hit. He told the council financing the $20 million project still hinges on government support.
The whole key to making the Polaris building a success is gathering the subsidy sources that exist, you know, with the various local and federal, state and federal governments to make it work. Because the bottom line is, the building is functionally obsolete. It costs more to put it together than it's worth in this market.
Marlow pointed to the Polaris's mix of retail and housing space, which he said make it eligible for federal new market tax credits he hopes to tap for $6 million. He says the other 14 can be borrowed through Bureau of Indian Affairs financing he qualifies for. The city council seemed willing to give Marlow more time. Member Renee Staley expressed encouragement given the drawn-out time frame the council has become accustomed to on the Polaris project.
Well, I'm excited to see his report coming so soon, 3 weeks after the September deadline, to be quite honest with you. So I'm absolutely ecstatic to see what that report brings.
Fellow council member Bernard Gatewood was also receptive to waiting a little longer due to the city's limited options on the Polaris.
With the alternative being just demolishing the thing, I certainly want to give them the benefit of the doubt. It would certainly benefit our community if it was developed. I'm still hopeful. I'm certainly not ready to pull a plug on the project right now.
Another council member, Perry Wally, agreed extra time is warranted, citing the price of tearing down the Polaris.
It's going to be a huge cost burden to the city. So best case scenario, I mean, we have a wait and see attitude right now and see if he can really pull this project off.
Public safety concerns and a lack of action on the Polaris have prompted the city to move ahead on condemnation, a long process that would eventually allow its demolition, a job estimated to cost at least $5 million, money the city would have to seek from the state. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
New federal regulations on coal-fired energy should not affect Golden Valley Electric Association's restart of the Healy coal plant. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, GVEA President and CEO Corey Borgeson expects the plan to purchase and operate the Long Idle facility to remain on track.
Borgeson says GVEA management is still studying the new regulations, which impose tough new limits on carbon dioxide emissions from new coal-fired power plants. But he says it appears the new regs won't affect GVEA's plans to complete its purchase of Healy No. 2 by the end of the year and to fire up the $300 million power plant in about a year and a half.
We have obtained the financing for it. We've locked in the interest rate. And then we think that the first fire on coal will be in the first quarter of 2015.
GVEA officials hope bringing the 50-megawatt facility online will stabilize electricity rate increases by using more coal to generate up to 20% of the co-op's electricity. Borgeson says GVEA is complying with the terms of a consent decree that it agreed to last year to get the go-ahead to buy Healy 2 from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for reportedly about $45 million. He says GVEA now has the necessary EPA permits to operate Healy 2 by agreeing to outfit it with some $40 million worth of emission controls and by retrofitting the older 25-megawatt Healy 1 coal-fired plant with another $5 million worth of pollution controls.
We've had the permit for Unit 2 some time, and it was updated and approved as part of the consent decree process.
Healy 2 was built in the mid-1990s with federal funding in an effort to demonstrate so-called clean coal technology. The plant was mothballed in 1999 after it failed to accomplish that, and it languished for several years until GVEA began negotiating in earnest to buy it in 2009. EPA's regulations affect only new coal-fired power plants, but the agency is expected to announce more regs next year to limit CO2 emissions from existing power plants. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Matanuska Susitna Borough voters will consider an alcohol tax proposition on the October 1st election ballot. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the 5% tax would be used to offset the burden on borough property owners, but Opponents of the plan say it unfairly targets a specific industry.
The ballot wording of Proposition B1 is simple. Shall the Matanuska Sioux City Borough enact an area-wide alcoholic beverage tax not to exceed 5% on sales of alcoholic beverages within the borough? Voters need only to check a yes or a no answer. The issue itself is far more complicated. The proposed alcohol tax was introduced in June by Matsu Borough Assemblyman Steve Culligan. After public hearings, it was approved as a ballot initiative in July. Culligan says he simply wants to reduce the tax obligation on borough property owners, who now foot the bill for most of the borough's expenses. Assemblyman Steve Culligan.
Not a big fan of new taxes. I've had people call me about sin taxes, et cetera. This is a sales tax on alcohol to offset costs that are currently being paid by property owners. And it, for me, it's pure and simple of why should property owners be bearing the full burden? We'll see how the public reacts and go from there.
But the 24-page ordinance covers a lot of ground. Sellers must collect the tax at the time of sale and hold it for the borough. The borough director of finance may conduct audits or investigations into a seller's tax receipts. Violations of the ordinance can result in a $500 fine and a prohibition against further alcohol sales. Dwayne Hart, owner of Knick Country Liquor, a privately owned company with several outlets in the valley, calls the proposition, quote, unfortunate, but he would not go on record for this story. Hart says similar alcohol tax initiatives have failed in the Kenai Peninsula Borough and in Anchorage. The Alaska Academy of Family Physicians and the Matsu Health Foundation have jumped on board in support of Prop B1, citing health reasons. Matsu Health Foundation Executive Director Elizabeth Ripley says her organization has completed a community-based health indicator survey.
And alcohol and substance abuse was ranked the number one issue in 23 community meetings. It was ranked number one or number two 83% of the time. So we have this mandate from our community, our business community, our medical community, our youth, our education community, all ranked alcohol and substance abuse as the number one issue in Matsu.
Ripley says state taxes on alcohol have reduced alcohol-related mortality rates. But critics say there is little in the proposed ordinance's language to indicate how the tax revenue will be spent. The only specific mention indicates the revenues will go into the borough's general fund to be spent on education and area-wide emergency services. Alaska's Cabaret, Hotel, and Restaurant and Retailers Association, or CHAR, represents more than 600 members statewide. CHAR President Dale Fox says there is no assurance that the tax revenues from liquor will be well spent.
Because all of the money goes to the general fund, and the politicians can spend it any way they want to. If the Matsu voters are liberal enough to arbitrarily tax a segment of the society to raise government spending, if that's what they want, then they should vote in favor of this. If not, they should vote no.
Opponents of Prop B1 also say the proposed ordinance would not only lead to higher prices for consumers, but would add to records-keeping burdens for sellers. Not so, Culligan says. He says it's no different from other sales taxes, now already the norm in Palmer and Wasilla.
Most revenue will come from probably within the city limits where most of the activity is, and in that case, it will only be about 2%. It will be the difference of their current sales tax and 5%. They're already collecting sales tax, so I don't think that will be an additional issue. Outside of that area, outside the city boundaries, they will have to, at their cash registers, just like any other business, adjust to collect sales tax.
Assemblyman Culligan says the fairest tax of all is a consumption tax. He says the borough will have to cut services unless more revenue sources can be found. Now it's up to Valley voters to decide. Matsu Borough voters go to the polls on Tuesday, October 1st, to vote on Prop B1, a transportation initiative, and on two borough assembly seats. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Throwing out visitors who overstay their welcome is a common late-night practice in bars. But one guest last night was particularly unwelcome at Juneau's Alaskan Hotel and Bar. KTOO's Jeremy Shea has the story.
A 12-second clip of grainy black and white security camera footage is making its rounds on social media. The clip shows a black bear's brief visit Monday night to the lobby of the Alaskan Bar. C. Scott Fry, the hotel and bar manager, was next door in the hotel lobby. He watched the black bear pass his door on the sidewalk.
And as soon as it got to the bar door, it made a left and walked in like he wanted to have a beer.
Ariel Svetlik McCarthy was tending bar last night. She says it was quiet up to that point. She realized the bear was inside.
And then freaked out and went, "No bear, get out! No, you can't be in here!"
Within seconds, the black bear obliged. It looked underage too, she quips. Area management biologist Ryan Scott with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game recalls bears visiting Bartlett Regional Hospital and private homes, but he says bears going inside buildings is rare. As far as this incident,
sounds to me like they did great, and it's good news the bear did oblige.
Wildlife officials have put down two nuisance bears in Juneau this summer. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
We independent Alaskans may think we're not joiners, but we are. It turns out two-thirds of us belong to the Alaska Airlines Mileage Plan. Marilyn Romano, the airline's in-state vice president, says we use it, especially during this summer's Extra Miles promotion.
Alaskans earned, for the double miles, 530 million miles this summer, or the equivalent of 21,000 round-trip saver tickets.
Romano announced the numbers during last week's Southeast Conference meeting in Sitka. She shared other evidence that we're joiners. She says half of us are members of the airline's Club 49 plan. That offers additional discounts, including checked luggage deals for Alaskans.
Our bag fees system-wide are set to go up October 1. So actually the savings to Alaskans even gets better come October 1, when you would normally pay $25 for the first two bags, Alaskans get those first two bags free.
The current checked bag fee is $20 each. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Wyoming, Emily Schwing, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Ed Schoenfeld and Jeremy Shea in Juneau. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Calling all Alaskan artists. Alaska Public Media's annual art showcase and auction is February 6th through the 8th. This unique opportunity features Alaskan artists and their work in fine arts media in a live auction televised around the state and in an online catalog. Deadline for submission is December 16th. Visit alaskapublic.org for more information. Proceeds benefit Alaska Public Media.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.